Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I'd like to thank the people who subscribe to this program and support the work that we do here, including Margaret Anderson, Josiah Phillips, Teresa Paris, and Rolf N. No last name. Your support is welcome. Go to peterbcollins.com and follow the links under my picture. You're about to hear the first of a two-part podcast series about the NSA-4. And I do apologize, you're going to hear some references that our interview with Tom Drake will be in the second portion of this podcast. We decided after the fact to turn it into two separate podcasts, so my apologies if you get confused. But we will release these interviews at one-day intervals, and I hope that you will absorb them both. They are very important. About our Fourth Amendment rights and the creeping surveillance state in these United States. Today, we bring you in-depth coverage of the NSA-4 here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Hello, NSA. I just called you to say I love you.
I love you
because you.
Because you.
Really listen.
Roy Zimmerman, give us another verse, will you?
Now when I'm on the phone, well, I never feel alone. Cause you're out there with your headphones.
Hello.
And you really listen.
Oh, yeah. Over at NSA, they really listen. And the NSA-4 is a group of courageous individuals, and like so many whistleblowers, they never intended to wear that label. They were all high-ranking employees at the National Security Agency, and they exposed bid rigging, cronyism, and fraud at the NSA. Now, back before 9/11, the NSA exclusively monitored outside the United States. But after 9/11, with no direct approval from Congress, the NSA started surveillance programs within the U.S. Thomas Drake is the best known of the NSA-4. We've covered his prosecution and plea bargain here. William Binney, who spent 35 years at NSA, is with us now. Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tim Shorrock is an investigative reporter and has been contributing to The Nation magazine since 1983. He's the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing, and in the April 15 print edition of The Nation and online at thenation.com. You should read his detailed report on the NSA-4. It's the best account I've seen of the whistleblowers who try to protect our constitutional rights and expose the huge waste of taxpayer dollars. Tim, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Bill Binney, give us a brief summary about what you reported and about how they retaliated against you and your three colleagues.
Okay, well, we basically had two thrusts of complaints that we focused internally in the government. One was to the Inspector General of the Department of Defense. We were outlining a lot of corruption, fraud, waste, and abuse internally at NSA. And the other was basically to talk about all of the violations of the constitutional rights of virtually every citizen of the United States And that was that had to do with spying internally on what they were doing. And we focused those complaints to the House Intelligence Committee, the Inspector General, the Department of Justice, as well as any number of people in Congress, all of which produced absolutely nothing. They simply ignored us. Actually, it probably created more of an incentive for them to send the FBI at us and raid us to try to keep us quiet and intimidate us. And as a part of that process, they also tried to falsify, in other words, frame us in terms of trying to get a criminal prosecution going against us. That was what they did at least three times over 4 or 5 years. They were doing that.
Mm-hmm. And the retaliation against you was in the form of blackballing you from government contracts after you left the NSA. And in the case of Tom Drake, they threw a bunch of charges at him, including very serious indictments under the Espionage Act. And he ended up deciding it was wiser to plead guilty to a very minor charge than to try to take on the government and possibly bankrupt himself and come up with nothing better than came out of the plea bargain deal. Tim Shorrock, you've covered the privatization of intelligence work, particularly since 9/11. Tell us briefly why the NSA-4 case is important to you.
Well, as you mentioned at the top of the show, I wrote the book Spies for Hire, and in that book I did write quite a bit about this project, a contracted project called Trailblazer, that Bill and the other whistleblowers spoke to the Office of Inspector General about in terms of fraud, waste, and corruption. And I had written about Trailblazer in my book, along with many other privatized programs, but only from the point of view of, I could only get public sources and talk to people that might comment on it from the outside. But, of course, none of my information came from inside the intelligence community or inside the NSA because it's all very secret and there are laws about talking, about exposing classified information. And so it was difficult in some ways because I could only rely on that, but I did get pretty much of the story in my book and articles I've also written for The Nation and others. And so encountering the NSA-4 and, meeting him, I first met Tom Drake, and then he introduced me to Bill and the others. It was eye-opening to me because, here I had written about it from the outside and, the very serious problems of privatization that I encountered. And then I could hear about it, directly from people who had direct experience with this. And so that was quite amazing to me. And talking to them over the past year as I've been developing this article, I've learned an incredible amount about how the NSA actually works and operates and has operated for quite some time, and particularly the role that these large contractors played in this program, Trailblazer, and other programs that the NSA and other agencies run.
Very good. Now, Bill Binney, you are described as a genius. You started working at the NSA way back in the Vietnam era in 1966. You left the agency in some sort of disgust in October of 2001. Sketch for our listeners your role, to the extent that it's declassified, at the NSA, and the challenges that you faced in 2001, just prior to the attacks of 9/11.
Okay, well, basically my role there at NSA for at least 28 years was to break codes and deal with ciphers and work on ways and means to attack different ciphers on the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. Basically military intelligence. So I never really thought of myself as a genius. I always thought of myself as a simpleton. I always like to think of problems and break them down into little subsections so you can start to understand the problem to try to keep it pretty simple and straightforward so you could solve it. And that's really all I ever did for that period of time was focus on that. These were all foreign military, so it wasn't anything that was domestic. And so in 1997, I became the technical director of the World Geopolitical and Military Intelligence Production Office, and that was a rather large office, about 6,000 analysts, and it covered the entire world, so I had to open up my thinking as to what the technical problems were in the world that were the most important to face and what we needed to solve. And so that's when I said, with a number of others, we decided to attack the ballooning communications in the world, which seemed to be the most prominent problem we were facing at the time. This was in the mid-90s, 1990s. And so we developed a program called Thin Thread that allowed us to... that really focused on massive volumes of data and how you could attack it, break it down, and simplify the process of figuring out what was important for you to look at in that data, as opposed to like a Google search when you get millions of returns. You don't want to go through those millions. Most of them are worthless, you know, or repetitive repeats of things you've already got. So you want to simplify it as much as you can, which is what we did, and that basically solved the problem of volume, velocity, and variety, and so we were able to make that, it really simplified the entire problem, so it made it, and actually, since the Internet, which is one of the main focuses we had, as well as the public switch telephone network, was dealing with international standards, that problem was really pretty simple compared to the previous problems we were working with the militaries. I mean, These problems here are standard. So once you have a solution, you have a solution for the world. It doesn't change that much, you know. So that solution ran up against a program that was started by General Hayden called Trailblazer, which was a multi-billion, I think it was a little over $4 billion to start with, program that was to address the same issue of the Internet and the ballooning communications in the world.
All right, now let's come back to Trailblazer in a moment, focusing on Thin Thread. This was essentially a homegrown inside the agency project, and you collaborated with one of the other members of the so-called NSA-4, Edward Loomis, on this. And as Shorrock describes it in his article, Loomis worked on the front end, analyzing incoming streams of Internet traffic, and your focus was on the back end. It's described here as the most powerful element of the system. It translated the data to create graphs showing relationships and patterns that could tell analysts which targets they should look at and which calls should be listened to. And it's you go on here, it was fully automated and could even be remotely controlled. Now, from my point of view as a hardliner on the Bill of Rights, Bill Binney, one of the other important factors here that distinguishes Thin Thread from Trailblazer is that your system protected the constitutional rights, particularly the Fourth Amendment rights, of Americans in the United States.
Yes, that's correct. Any time we ran across anything that was identifiable as a U.S. citizen or someone inside the United States, we would encrypt all their attributes so you couldn't know who they were or identify them.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually never kept their data. We threw their data away.
Mm-hmm. And let me just point out that last year the Obama administration made an internal decision to hold on to data, even in relation to individuals who are not suspects or who have never been charged. That information used to be destroyed after 6 months, and now the policy is it can be held for up to 5 years.
Actually, they've been holding it since 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
That data has been collected since 9/11 and stored.
Right.
It's nothing, and they get away with all of the protections for U.S. citizens that we built into Thin Thread. That was thrown away so that there was no protection whatsoever. And all that data was just stored for the last 12 years. So what they can do now is do retroactive policing of all that information if they have, or go after people like General Petraeus or General Allen and pull out all their data and review it and see if there's anything that's suspicious or anything they can use as leverage against them.
And, Bill, as somebody who devoted your career to the NSA and primarily to foreign intelligence gathering, how would you describe your level of alarm about the creeping police state here in the United States, specifically related to electronic surveillance?
Well, it was really discouraging to see our Constitution being so violated. I mean, that was really so disturbing. I couldn't have any part of that. That's why I left NSA, as well as Ed Loomis and Kirk Wiebe joined me, and we all just couldn't stick. We couldn't stay there and be associated with such such a criminal act. So we had to leave, mm-hmm. and that's when we all tried to talk to other people in the government and get them to try to openly address these issues so that they could change and become and try to change that entire process to make it more constitutionally acceptable. Instead, they kept going on the dark side, which, by the way, they never had to do from the beginning, because we had no problem whatsoever identifying terrorists or anybody else that was doing some kind of malicious activity on the net.
Mm-hmm.
We had zero activity. We had zero difficulty doing that. They went to the dark side because they wanted to. That's what happened.
Now, there are also substantial gaps in the cost. The
yes.
Thin Thread program, which, as I pointed out, was generated internally, had a total cost in the range of $3 million. Is that correct, Bill?
It was about $3.2 million, yes.
Okay. And in the end, Trailblazer ended up not working. It was scrapped. But after spending how much?
My understanding is a little over $4 billion, but Tom thinks it's probably twice that.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, Tim Shorrock, as you look at the way that the decision was made not to use this successful program that was developed internally, but to outsource this to government contractors, what you describe, and this is my characterization, is a feeding frenzy of contractors, including SAIC, and de-acronymize that one for me, would you please?
Science Applications International Corporation, but it likes to go by SAIC.
Okay, and most of us have never heard of that. I'm familiar with Booz Allen Hamilton. Most people know about Lockheed Martin and TRW. So these companies basically took the opportunity when Michael Hayden was made head of the NSA after the Bush team took office, and they basically pitched him on this privatized solution to an issue or a set of challenges that had already been dealt with at much lower cost internally.
Well, what happened, this actually happened before the Bush administration, because, you know, General Hayden came into NSA in 1999, which was still during the Clinton administration.
Right, yeah.
And he came in, and there had been, you know, some studies that Kirk Wiebe, for example, was involved in, where they were really taking a hard look at what the NSA's capabilities were and where it was falling down. And you know, there were a lot of reports at the time, well, a few reports in the U.S. press that, you know, the NSA was losing its ability to listen and, you know, was going deaf and so on. And so they really took a hard look and, you know, put together a group of inside people and some outside consultants, intelligence officials, NSA people, to take a long look at what they could do and what they might develop. And they came up with a plan to automate the collection and the analysis of signals intelligence. Then when Hayden came in, this report and recommendation had already been made, and he put together another group that was primarily made up of contractors and people in the private sector who urged a private sector solution. You know, take advantage of all the commercial technologies available out there, and it might be much better and cheaper and so on. And so, yes, he was sold on this idea. And if you read, you know, General Hayden's testimony in Congress before that time, you can see how completely enraptured he was by, you know, high-ranking corporate executives. And they really sold him on this. And they basically, I think they sold the NSA leadership on a bill of goods. They promised the sky, you know, that they, you know, when you talked, Hayden would say, this is going to revolutionize how they're going to analyze signals intelligence. And so the corporations promised all kinds of programs, many of which, you know, were already in place and would be part of this. And so he actually put together a group of companies to advise the NSA on how to actually construct this contract and how to actually, you know, perform it. And the companies, you know, came down and said, well, you should actually pick SAIC to run it. And that's essentially what happened. And so SAIC was given the master contract, the prime contract, and they had, you know, they were working with, you know, Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman, Booz Allen, and other companies. In fact, dozens of other companies were, you know, providing different kinds of programs, search programs, you know, anything that they would add to what they were trying to do. And so that, you know, the cost just began to escalate. And there were, you know, Congress actually began expressing concern a few years into it, saying, you know, where are we on this? And of course, they were, you know, quite alarmed after 9/11, and information came out, you know, in the months and year after 9/11, that actually the NSA had missed some messages, telephone messages in Arabic, that could have alerted them, in fact, to there was an attack going on in the next couple of days. This is, you know, prior to 9/11, and mm-hmm. So it was very clear that, you know, this program had not done what it was supposed to do, and it eventually ended up being canceled by the successor to Hayden, General Alexander, who still runs the NSA. And that was in 2006. So, you know, billions of dollars put into this, and basically, you know, at one point Newsweek called it a pile of junk, and that's essentially what it was. Mm-hmm. And so they went for this corporate program while Bill Binney and Ed Loomis and Kirk Wiebe had developed this program that did what they already wanted to do, that had solved the problem, as Bill just said.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they didn't want to, you know, they went with a corporate program. Why? You know, that's something that General Hayden and those people have to answer someday. But essentially, you know, there was just this huge number of contractors involved and lots of money.
And
made
Tim,
the NSA look good.
Tim, did the contractors divvy this up along lines that you would consider rational? In other words, they had expertise in certain technologies or analysis fields, or was this done on more of a political basis? Because we know that with defense and more recently with domestic homeland security and surveillance contracts, that some of this is split up so that it feeds companies that are located in different congressional districts or in different states, so that they win the support and sponsorship of influential members of Congress.
Well, I think that's very clear. That's in part what happened, because in some of the discussions I had, actually, you know, that I learned this from the NSA IV and just, you know, studying that period, was that, you know, there was a lot of, you know, privatization and outsourcing going on in intelligence, you know, long before 9/11. Of course, there was a large, you know, defense industrial complex here in the Washington area. You know, so it was already there. But then, you know, more and more, you know, companies, you know, got involved. And then after 9/11, of course, budgets just, you know, went through the roof for intelligence, and they were basically, you know, shoveling, you know, money, as much money as they possibly could, into these programs to find out, you know, what happened on 9/11 and make sure it doesn't happen again.
And Bill Binney, what's your comment on the way this was divvied up? And let me put names on it. Two of the powerful members of Congress who could make or break this kind of contracting were Republican Curt Weldon and Democrat Jack Murtha, both of Pennsylvania. And in each of their districts, they enjoyed loads of government spending, most often called pork, that they were able to deliver to their own districts. So do you have any information on the way they carved up the contract for Trailblazer?
Well, my problem with the contractors coming in to try to do an analytic job was that they had no expertise or background in doing that particular activity. In other words, if you had an engineering issue or a computer science issue, those were well-established fields that they had expertise in. But when you talk about being able to make intelligence from data or large amounts of data, that's a field where they have zero expertise at all. And so that when they came in and they didn't even ask for the requirements as to what needed to be done from the analytic force that existed in NSA. So they didn't even take advantage of that kind of knowledge that was inside the system already.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had, you know, the whole idea of just contracting it out was absurd to me from the very beginning.
And was there an RFP process? Were specs laid out? Was it competitive in any way, shape, or form?
Well, I think Tom is better to address this. I was basically the guy solving the problem. I wasn't the one managing the contracts or anything that were involved with Trailblazer, for mm-hmm. sure, and I didn't have a view into that. But my sense was there was.
I'm sorry, Tim, did you want to add something?
Well, I just said Tom basically thinks that it was a setup, and, you know, one of the things I wanted to add here was, you know, the full story of what happened in Trailblazer, you can't really trace it the way you've just described in terms of, like, you know, certain individual Congress people and their mm-hmm. districts and what's going on there, because, you know, all the information, the report that came out of the whistleblower's complaint, which was done by the Office of Inspector General in 2005, was classified secret. It's still classified. Little bits of it have been declassified. But the full story of what actually happened in terms of the companies and what they did and didn't do, you know, that won't, we can't see that until this is fully declassified. It's all still secret and, mm-hmm. you know, hidden behind this veil of secrecy that you know, hides many, many problems.
There okay. is one thing we can say, though,
mm-hmm.
and that is that Hayden and NSA management hired a vice president of SAIC to come in and manage all these transformation programs, Trailblazer, Groundbreaker, and all of them. So they had many multi-billion-dollar programs that now SAIC, an ex-SAIC vice president, was hired in to manage.
And then, as I describe in the article, he hires one of his people from SAIC to come in and run Trailblazer.
Mm-hmm.
And that individual, you know, the contract goes to SAIC, and then 2 years later he leaves and goes back to SAIC.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just this, you know, relationships between these very high-level officials there and these contractors.
See, that's at the heart of what we were complaining about, the corruption at NSA. And it really goes to a lot of agencies in the U.S. government. I mean, it's not limited to NSA.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now, Bill, a quick technical type question. James Bamford, who is the acknowledged expert on the NSA, has written 3 books about the agency. He told me a few years ago that one of the challenges NSA faced was that much of the signals that you used to intercept were distributed by satellite, which made it much easier for you to grab them. But with the shift to fiber optic circuits and internet traffic and communications and the addition of cell phones, that you faced new challenges that your old systems didn't address. To what extent were those issues in play as you developed Thin Thread and ran into agency resistance in deploying it, and they preferred Trailblazer with the massive costs and corporatization of it?
Well, the biggest shift that we saw was the fiber optic lines, okay? And so the question was, how do you get that kind of information off a fiber optic line? And Mark Klein basically outlined that in his court documentation of the splitters used to separate or to duplicate what was on the fiber optic lines in the San Francisco room of NSA.
Right, and let me just briefly say, Mark Klein has been on our program. He was the guy who blew the whistle on the secret room that was set up at Pacific Bell's, or now AT&T's, switch room on Folsom Street in San Francisco. And he's a real hero of mine, I have to say. He's very courageous in going public with that information. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, well, so the idea was to get copies of what was on the line, and then you could use NERIS devices to sessionize it, that is, reconstruct what was there, and then forward that for your database.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that basically is what they're doing, because the splitters sent that to the NSA room with the NERIS equipment there that was basically doing the sessionizing. I mean, the NERIS Insight device can sessionize 10 gigabits per second. That's 10 billion bits per second, which means that could translate into 1,250,000-character emails a second that it could reconstruct and give you for your database.
Wow. And this NERIS device, that's made by an Israeli company, right?
It was. I think it's been bought up by Boeing.
I see.
I think that that happened, a year or two ago?
That's correct. It's Naris went in. It was bought by Boeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And can you give us a little more of a less technical description of how this helps you analyze the massive amounts of traffic? And how are things tagged? Is it voice printing? Is it the origin either from a phone number or an IP address?
Right.
What are the various markers, Bill?
Well, if you go see, the international system is set up by data elements that identify you uniquely in the network of the world. Okay, for example, in the public switch telephone network, which is your standard telephone, you have a phone number, and that phone number really is unique in the world. So that if you start with the number one, that's area zone one of the world, of which there are nine zones. And that includes the U.S., Canada, and some of the islands in that go all the way out to Guam and down into the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the other zones of the world, 3 and 4, include northern, southern Europe, and 7 is Russia, and you know, and it goes all around the world. So that kind of number makes you unique in the world in that system. And similarly, in the internet world, you have a specific IP address that's unique to you, but you also have a MAC number, which is a machine access code. So every machine, computer, switch system, or data storage device has a unique address in the network of the world, so you can address that uniquely.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, and similarly, you could use user and user ID plus service provider as a combination of things. So there's many attributes that you could use that to help identify you in that network.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do then is use those attributes and build social networks, if you will, the relationships between those attributes as they communicate across the entire world. Then that gives you a picture of who's involved in communities of activity. That is, if you uniquely would have a community that you communicate with, some
mm-hmm.
would be your family, some would be business, and so on.
Yep.
And so that breaks down that way as subsets of your community of interest. But that's true of everybody in the world. And so when you lay that out, then that lays out all the relationships in the world. And so though you use those relationships then to help define who's involved in terrorist activities or dope smuggling or money laundering or any of those kinds of illegal activities.
And how is that data stream integrated with, for example, we know that the NSA made deals with the phone companies to either buy or just get the caller logs. So we're on the phone right now, and my phone bill is going to show a record of this call between me and Bill Binney and me and Tim Shorrock. So what value did the data mining of phone records have to the analysis of this huge amount of traffic?
There's two ways to produce intelligence. One is to read what they're saying and take advantage of it, what they're telling you.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is to look at relationships, how people relate from one to the other in a community over time. And that gives you an idea, gives you ideas on what they're doing. For example, if you're smuggling drugs, I've used this as an example. The fellow, like in Colombia, who wants to sell drugs to somebody in the United States has to have some relationship with that person so they can agree on an exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Then they have to have some other kind of relationship, either physically carrying money or doing an electronic transfer of money through systems that would also show a relationship. And then there has to be some relationship with someone who's going to transport the drugs and so on. So those kinds of relationships have to show up in that community of activity. And that gives you a profile of something that they're doing. And that then gives you the idea of how you can infer from their interaction what they're actually doing, even though you don't have any information that tells you verbally or in print what they are actually doing.
Okay.
So there's two ways to do it. And the other point is that these attributes can be used by the telecom systems to detect these kinds of events when they're occurring and route them to recorders or route them directly to the NSA rooms or so
mm-hmm.
on. They can filter that out for them also.
Okay. Now, Bill, take us back to the year 2001, and there's this internal struggle at the NSA over the internally developed and low-cost and Bill of Rights protecting thin thread and the cost runaway and dubious performance of Trailblazer, which, of course, is just being contracted out at that point. But as I understand it from Tim's article, there was a refusal to deploy thin thread just before 9/11, and it left us naked to intelligence that may have been a collectible, but either wasn't collected or wasn't properly analyzed before the attacks.
Yes, that's correct. we actually had everything running and in place and operating in several sites already by November of 2000. And so we were prepared to do a general deployment to any number of sites. We had picked 18 sites because those were the high important sites for collecting terrorist-related activity. So we proposed deploying to those 18 sites in January of 2001, which is like 7 to 8 months before 9/11. And most of it would have been, since our process was basically software, we would have downloaded electronically we would simply loaded the software out there on the equipment that already existed and at those sites, and they would start operating almost immediately. So the point was there wasn't a great deal of delay. I mean, there were some sites we'd have to send equipment to, but that was all built into the proposal that we had to start that deployment in January. And the idea was that once you did that, the rules that we would put into the code that operated those systems, since there were no operators there, it was fully remotely controlled, would simply any time they ran across those kinds of things that would happen between Al-Qaeda members or between Al-Qaeda and someone else or any other terrorist organizations, they would be immediately routed to everybody that would be interested to it in that particular those particular events, and it would be put at the top of their queue. So it wasn't a question of having people, which at the time was what they had to depend on, people going through the database finding information and recognizing and then taking action. Well, we had code that did that, and it did it within milliseconds of detection. So it wasn't a question of being incapable of recognizing things. It simply automated that process. That was the real key that would have alerted everybody to anything they were doing prior to 9/11.
And so in so many ways, this is symbolic of what's happened with intelligence and the privatization of intelligence, which is that, you know, the mission of these agencies, the mission of the NSA is compromised in favor of privatization and in favor of basically making money for large contractors and corporations. Because they had a system working here, it was doing its job, it could have done its job if it had been plugged in to the signals intelligence system as a deployable program. Instead, they said, "Well, we're going to just wait for this big, huge Trailblazer project to come forth and, you know, give us everything we need." And that's where there's a split between the mission and the money. And I think that's the essential problem here, is that, you know, the motivation of profit for these companies comes higher than the actual mission. And when that's blurred, you have a serious problem.
And Tim, I'm sorry, go ahead, Bill.
The total cost of that deployment to those 18 sites, we estimated to be $9.5 million. That was all.
Mm-hmm.
And that we proposed for January of 2001, and they refused to do it. That was because of all the opposition by the companies and also by internal management of NSA. Because when you do that kind of thing, it takes away from their building of an empire, you know, a budget and a staff.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tim, if we zoom out from, you know, just the NSA, this is one of many failures, breakdowns that occurred prior to 9/11. Was this explored at all by the 9/11 Commission? I don't recall in any of the public testimony or publication that there was much of a look at the NSA. And I don't know that anyone was disciplined for this failure. They actually were given more money and more latitude to violate the Constitution.
Well, no, we don't know. If there have been reports that there were the decisions made by the Office of Inspector General to pass some names on for possible prosecution, but we don't know what happened with that, and clearly, you know, none of these people were prosecuted or investigated. General Hayden, of course, was, you know, after this program was canceled, that was supposed to be the heart of his, you know, revolutionary program, that was canceled. I mean, he was promoted. He became the director of the CIA, and then he went into a high position in the Office of Director of National Intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's working, you know, for the Chertoff Group in a position where he's the, you know, the key cybersecurity person at this firm, and he has regular, you know, conversations and discussions with the NSA and other agencies, and he advises corporations on cybersecurity. So yes, he's been rewarded, as have his colleagues who worked with him there. Have gone on to very high level positions in contractors like CSC, which is a very close NSA contractor.
And
that's another scam that they're pulling on us with cybersecurity.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of the what they're doing is trying to build another empire, when in fact the basic question they should be looking at should be intruder detection.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if you can detect an intruder coming into your system, you don't care what his attack is, what the latest version of his attack is. All you need to know is that he's an intruder, and you stop him.
And
that's cybersecurity.
And another, you know, I've heard Bill say, you know, techno babble. You know what these corporations say, and what, you know, the people in the agencies that believe them say. You know, it's like they come out there and say, oh, there's going to be a cyber 9/11. You know, you got to listen to us, and you know, it's a way to keep the scare factor up, the fear factor up,
and that's how they get money.
Yeah. Well, and we only hear half of the story, because we talk about assaults from China or Iran or elsewhere on the internet or sites in the United States, but we play down our own aggressive role in cyber warfare, and my argument is that kind of warfare is just like landing troops or launching missiles, and that it should be debated and authorized by Congress, but it's basically just permitted to occur. You know, my concern is that we create some of the blowback that is described simply as assaults on the United States. Bill, do you have a comment on that?
Well, yeah, but that's where they can see if they emphasize the assaults on the United States, that's where they can drum up fear and do the fear mongering to gain more leverage and greater influence and get more money. That's really the emphasis they need. That's where they put their emphasis, instead of taking a simple approach at how do you defend a network from somebody intruding into it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the point is to detect the intruder. You don't care what his attack is. It can be anything under the sun. What you need to do is to be able to detect that person coming into your system.
And a lot of the debate about cybersecurity is also, right now, is about the role of the National Security Agency. The National Security Agency has made it very clear that it's got to be at the very center of anything that happens with cybersecurity. There was some legislation last year that never made it through Congress, but you know, one piece of legislation wanted to have the NSA at the center of the policy of cybersecurity, and the other one had the Department of Homeland Security, and there was actually a lot of debate about whether the NSA should be in the middle of it. And actually, you know, they are in charge of cyber policy for the United States government, but that hasn't happened yet, where they've been, you know, directed to be at the center of it. And what they want to do, and what you hear these NSA directors and officials talking about, is they want to have 24/7 access to everything that's happening on the internet. And you know, given what the NSA has gone through and what they've done, and the laws that they violated and the Constitution that they violated, do we want to have the NSA in charge of this kind of policy? I think not.
Well, you see, what they're really doing is asking for legislation that would justify and legalize what they're already doing and have been doing for over 12 years.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, all these devices, the Nerus devices that they have on the networks around the world, including in the United States inside, are already taking all that information in. And, for example, if you remember the virus they got in the inside the the Pentagon, which somebody loaded in by bringing in some kind of disk or something. And then they detected that internally in the closed system in the Pentagon, so it didn't really do any damage. But they also said at the same time that they detected a ping to that virus on the network, which means the web, international web, to try to send information back. Well, that tells you they're already monitoring all that information with those Anaris devices and picking all that data up. I mean, a ping simply activates something on the, in the virus to have it send data back. Okay, so that tells you the degree and the extent to which they're doing this deep packet inspection of the web already.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they're asking under the cybersecurity issue of the legislation is to legalize what they're already doing.
Well, and your comment about empire building really resonates, Bill, because one of my windows into this is through Sibel Edmonds, who co-hosts a podcast with me. She was working at the FBI as a translator after 9/11 and was fired for whistleblowing of a penetration by foreign agents. But one of the things that she reported was that her supervisor would have her spend a whole day doing translations, and then at the end of the day, he would just delete them and tell her to start over. And the clear message was that they were trying to build and maintain a backlog of translations so that they could get a bigger budget and hire more translators. And when you see this, and, you know, these are very serious national security related investigations, to see that subjugated to the empire building and the budget expansion of some of these departmental leaders, it's really frightening.
Yes, and if you look at what they're doing in terms of word search and things like that that they've been using, like Google does, what that does is that brings it and dumps it in hundreds of thousands, not millions of items on you in the database that they have. You get millions of returns. And so at that point, you say, well, I can't handle this. And so that's justification for a bigger empire, okay? That's the same issue there with data. It's as they do with transcripts that you just mentioned. It's the same approach, saying we have too much data. Instead of trying to figure out a way to see through all the data that you don't even want to look at, filter that all out and simplify your process like we did with ThinThread.
Now,
but that doesn't give you any justification for increasing your empire.
Go ahead, Tim.
Excuse me. And this is why, of course, the NSA is building and is almost finished building this massive storage facility in Utah, in the deserts of Utah, which James Bamford wrote about a year ago in Wired magazine. You know, to collect all this data and store it, and so they can go back. And incidentally, if you look at wanted ads in that area of Utah, you're going to see many ads for SAIC and the same companies involved with Trailblazer for that facility right there. So the empire continues.
World's biggest data farm, and I still can't get my arms around what a yottabyte is. Tim, there were two things that fascinated me in your article in The Nation. One is the description that in order to sell Trailblazer, they built essentially a demonstration facility in the National Business Park near Fort Meade. And you write, there, the agency and its contractors showed their system off to congressional overseers and intelligence leaders. And you quote Thomas Drake. He said, it was just show and tell, a dog and pony show, very large screens, fancy computers stacked up, a director's place in the middle. But I have to tell you, there was nothing behind it. That reminds me of the Enron trading room at the Enron headquarters in Houston, which was just like a movie set. It didn't really actually do anything, but when they had high-profile visitors, they told people to come down to this floor and act like you're trading. That is quite bizarre.
Well, and actually, that Enron, description is exactly what Tom said to me at one point. He said it was just like Enron.
Really?
It was all phony, and it was just a show and tell. And then there was nothing behind it. And that's what they did, and that's how these guys were convinced. And, you know, by the way, that's a very large, you know, business park. If you want, you know, people that come to Washington, I always tell them, take a drive, you know, in the northern Virginia, the area near the CIA, and then take a drive near the NSA and near Columbia, Maryland, and go, you know, a few blocks over, and there's this big business park where SAIC, Booz Allen, Lockheed, all these companies have great big buildings. And there it is, the privatized side of NSA.
Well, you don't even have to go that deep. You can see all the logos on the office buildings if you're coming in from Dulles Airport to the Capitol.
That's right.
And Bill Binney, you describe how, despite your development of Thin Thread, that Michael Hayden never actually visited to see a demo of Thin Thread. He may have gone to the Trailblazer mock-up, but he apparently had no real interest in comparing your work with the promise of the outside contractors.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, he never came down, but Bill Black, his deputy, did. And he had said that when he was there and saw it, he said, "My God, you guys have made so many breakthroughs here, you ought to be making this announcement out there in the open real loud." Well, every time we did, we got hit, you know, by or attacked from different directions, so that internally in the NSA, it wasn't something that they particularly, they didn't want us succeeding. In other words, that's why I thought of their a vision statement of the military-industrial complex was keep the problem going so the money keeps flowing.
Mm-hmm.
That was my perception of their vision statement. I mean, that's what they've been doing for decades anyway. That's why I got into the business of running contracts myself, because I couldn't get anybody to do the right thing for the mission in the NSA.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bill, I want to talk about what happened to you. And first, I want to add the description from Jim Bamford that you were such a high-ranking official that you were the equivalent of a military general. And yet you quit in October of 2001. You were given permission to set up a company and compete for contracts, but then they blackballed you, and you were basically frozen out of that. And with the prosecution of Tom Drake, you described to Tim Shorrock that you'd like them to indict you because it would be a way for you to get into a courtroom and flesh out the whistleblowing charges that you have leveled so far. Talk a little bit about that. Are you really eager to face the phalanx of government lawyers and the limits on any information that you'd be able to introduce in such a trial?
Well, I may not be able to introduce it in a trial or in the courtroom itself, but I could certainly do it on the steps of the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the problem. See, I wanted to raise the issues up to the public. I mean, the public is not waking up to what's going on here. What I see here happening, like if you look at the NDAA that President Obama signed a little over a year ago,
yeah,
in there it said that he has the right now to, if he has anybody that he thinks is a terrorist, he can take away, even if they're a U.S. citizen, he can take away their constitutional rights, put them in, incarcerate them, and give them no due process.
That's Section 1021B. I actually know that pretty well.
And that's very similar, if you go back and look in history, to the 1933 General Order 48 issued by the Nazis to take away the constitutional rights under the Weimar Republic of the citizens of Germany. And that's exactly what they did. And they incarcerated all the communists and everybody else and anybody they didn't like and got rid of them. That was that step toward doing that. So, you know, there's very similar historical parallels going on here.
Mm-hmm.
That our country is going down this very slippery slope to a totalitarian state. I mean,
well,
history has shown this time and again.
I thank you for being an insider who's willing to stand up and confront that ugly reality. It's very important to me, Bill. Tim, as you look at this picture, we have four whistleblowers with very credible issues that have been swept under a virtual rug. The wall of secrecy that envelops the NSA makes it difficult, and that's compounded by the Obama and Holder decision to look forward, not backward, which I consider to be an open form of obstruction of justice. Will we ever see the real facts, even declassified matters related to the boondoggle of Trailblazer, and will anybody be held accountable for its failure?
Well, I certainly hope so. It's very hard to say whether that'll happen, but I think, you know, a lot of people in the 1970s had no idea that a committee called it, you know, led by Senator Church would uncover these intelligence abuses that they did. And it was sort of serendipity, but it was very critical to those hearings. Getting those hearings started was reports in the press. Seymour Hersh broke some very big stories in the New York Times about the CIA doing domestic intelligence. Other reports came out about other agencies doing domestic intelligence. In the hearings themselves, and there were also House hearings, that's when the NSA, you know, and Bamford's book goes into this quite a bit, you know, when they brought NSA people in and they finally spilled the beans about, you know, doing domestic surveillance. And that's what led to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, you know, to require warrants before they spied on American citizens and American residents. So, you know, right now it doesn't look very likely because of what you said about this whole, you know, not looking back and just looking forward. But, you know, at some point, I think enough people are going to wake up, and it's important. I feel incumbent as a journalist, as a reporter, and an American citizen to keep the focus on these kinds of abuses and to keep talking about them and keep publishing about them and find other whistleblowers and keep talking to the whistleblowers we're talking to now so the American people know the truth, because the Obama administration and the NSA and these other agencies, the military-industrial complex and all these corporations are doing as much as they can to shut us up and to keep quiet and to make and use this secrecy to keep people silent and not talk, and then the threat of being persecuted and prosecuted. It's a very, very scary thing. I mean, I take it for granted that my calls are monitored when I talk to Bill, and he says, of course they are, you know, when I talk to Tom or Bill. But that's a violation of our rights, all of our rights.
Yeah. Well, and the Supreme Court just sealed that one with the denial of standing in the ACLU wiretap case. We had the Al Haramain case, which was granted standing because they could prove from declassified materials that, or actually unclassified, to be clear.
No, actually, that was proven by a slip of classified information to
well,
the lawyer.
No, Tim. In fact, in the final case, Judge Walker accepted evidence of their wiretapping that did not come from the FBI memo or whatever other document that fell into their laps.
But that's how it first came out, though.
You are correct, yeah. But in the end, they were able to substantiate the fact that they had been wiretapped, and even still, that case has been dropped. The attorneys decided they really thought it was too risky to take it forward on appeal. So
right.
We basically, because of the immunity granted to the phone companies, that route is blocked. The standing issue blocks our access to the courts unless we can prove that we've been wiretapped. And so we have a series of catch-22s that prevent that. Bill Binney, any comment from you on possible accountability?
Well, the only hope I have is with the EFF lawsuit, Juul versus NSA, which I signed an affidavit for, trying to testify to the, what was going on. And that has to do with addressing the constitutionality of NSA or any other government agency actually accumulating all this information about U.S. citizens. In other words, it's getting at the secret interpretations of Section 215 of the Patriot Act and 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. And if we can get that going into the Supreme Court, which is where we hope it goes, and get it declared unconstitutional, then all of those interpretations, all those, even the immunity to telecoms, can fall as unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And all their house of cards will fall if that happens.
Well, I hope to live to see that, and I hope you live to see it too, Bill.
I certainly do too, yeah.
Any final comments from either one of you? I really appreciate your contributions here today. Bill, you first?
Oh, I'd just like to say thanks for having us on, because this is an issue that a lot of people don't realize the extreme gravity of it. You know, they just really don't realize the threats here.
And Tim, a final from you?
Well, I think we really owe a debt of gratitude to Bill and the other whistleblowers for telling us the truth and sticking to that truth despite what they faced and continuing to talk about this. It's because of people like Bill that we know about this. And we owe a huge amount to him and other whistleblowers who have the courage to stand up against this state surveillance system we have.
My thanks to reporter Tim Shorrock. And again, his important book is called Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And the article we've been referring to is available at thenation.com. And my thanks, too, to William Binney. I really appreciate your courage in speaking up.
Thank you.
Be sure to listen to the second installment of this two-part podcast series about the NSA-4 and the creeping rollbacks in your Fourth Amendment rights. The next installment, a powerful interview with NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake here on the Peter B. Collins Show. I want to thank you for listening and hope you'll spread the word. I think every American needs to hear what you just heard.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until